Good evening. Wanted to talk tonight and the next few talks that I give about the focus on the Satipatthana Sutta, usually translated as the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. So it's the Pali Canon sutras, and one of the most important texts on Buddhist meditation. Across traditions, I think, and it has a lot to say about mindfulness, or certainly the commentaries do, which is a trendy word these days. So it's want to try to get to the sort of the Buddhist roots of mindfulness and how we may understand this. So this text actually. It's translated as the Four Foundations or Establishments or Four Methods of Mindfulness. Four being the body, feelings, mind, and dharmas or objects of mind or our perception. Bhikkhu Anilayo, who's written this really thorough commentary with all these footnotes. One of those who like to geek out on these things. So he doesn't like the translation foundations of mindfulness so much because it emphasizes the object rather than the activity itself. It's the body isn't merely a foundation for mindfulness. It's we shouldn't treat our body just as a means towards the establishment of mindfulness. That's sort of to reduce the body and it's setting up this duality. It's rather like mindfulness is the foundation of mindfulness. And you might think of this instead as four ways of being present with mindfulness. And within these four ways, there are, you know, little subdivisions, a little more paths. As we humans are sentient beings, we direct our attention towards that which we're able to perceive and sense, what we can be aware of. According to Buddhist psychology, the attention is actually a universal quality, that we are always attentive of something. And wise attention is when we are attentive to the here and now, and unwise attention is when our mind is wandered off and scattered and drift. The word sati in the Satipatthana is it's a mindfulness, usually translated in Sanskrit, it's smriti. And the root is actually like to remember, to recall. And you may think of it to remember the present moment. In Chinese, Thich Nhat Hanh points this out, the Chinese character for mindfulness has two parts. And one of them just means now, and the other one is mind or heart. I think it's the same part as like the Heart Sutra or the Daihi Shin Dharani in Buddhism. There's not a distinguishment between mind and heart. It's like the one word. Sometimes it's translated as heart mind, therefore hyphenated. So might say that like to have our heart mind in the present moment, this mindfulness. So it's to remember and come back to the present moment, and to have also the presence of mind to remember where our life is actually lived, right here and right now. So at the beginning and also the end of this text, and so just in the translation here, you know, it's about 11 pages, I think. It's just to give you a sense of the length of this text. It's not very long. It doesn't take too long to read. But as this scene has been set, as is usually the case in the sutras, and telling us where the Buddha taught and addressing the assembly of monks, he says, "Monks, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha, suffering and discontent, for the acquiring the true method for the realization of nirvana, namely the four satipatthanas." And at the end, he repeats this. Well, first he says, after introducing all of these four, comes the part that Anālaya calls the prediction. He says, "Monks, if anyone should develop these four satipatthanas in such a way for 7 years, one or two fruits could be expected for him. Either final knowledge here and now, or if there's a trace of clinging left, non-returning." So this is like the completely enlightened here, or if there's a little trace left or something, when you pass away, there'll be the, you know, will be enlightened fully. And it says, let alone if you were to practice this for 7 years, or for 6 years, or for 5, or 4, or 3, or 2, or 1 year, or 7 months, 6 months, 5 months, 4 months, 3 months, 2 months, 1 month, half a month. If anyone should develop these four satipatthanas in such a way for 7 days, one of these two fruits would be expected. Yeah. And so it's with reference with this, he said, you know, repeated what he said in the beginning, like, this is a direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method, for the realization of nibbana, namely the four satipatthanas. And we're told that the monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Supposedly, like, just if we could really do this fully, just for 7 days. This is for 7 days. That's it. which is the story is that the time that the Buddha sat on the Bodhi tree, more often in Zen we do a 7-day sesshin. Traditionally, that's the length of an intensive retreat, is to just fully dedicate yourself to 7 days. And in Zen, we emphasize this of practicing with no gaining idea. Right? It's not about reaching that goal. We're just, our practice is here and now, and that's the focus rather than where we're going to get. So it's striking, therefore, to say that the sutra, at least in this translation, assess that this is the direct path for, you know, ending suffering. You know, it's not the direct path to, I think, which would be a sort of a duality of like this will lead to that, but it is, I read this the direct path for the purification of being, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation. It's like when you're practicing, you know, truly practicing right mindfulness, as an aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path, along with the others, there's already the ceasing of suffering right there. It's not a future goal, but each moment of wholehearted practice is each moment of realization, like Dogen says. Thich Nhat Hanh says, to cultivate mindfulness in ourselves is to cultivate the Buddha within. So when we have a moment of mindfulness, the Buddha is present there, the Buddha within. The term ekayana, it is in Pali that Anilaya translates as the direct path. Thich Nhat Hanh translates it as, it's the same term that's used in the Lotus Sutra to describe the one vehicle. Thich Nhat Hanh translates it as a most wonderful way to help living beings. However, there is, so this is the direct path, and in Buddhist teaching, like, mindfulness has a very direct role in our practice and in our awakening. And this has maybe been co-opted quite a bit in mainstream society in the last however many, you know, couple of decades or so. So it's important to distinguish between right and wrong mindfulness. So the Noble Eightfold Path talks about, you know, right concentration, right effort, right mindfulness, you know, so forth, right livelihood, right speech. The authors Ron Purser and David Loy wrote this article in 2013, I think, called Beyond Mac Mindfulness. They coined the term, I think, Mac Mindfulness. I think they coined it to sort of criticize the commodification of mindfulness and that sort of the cheapening it and selling it and separating it out from the other aspects of Buddhist practice. In the West, we've kind of been quick to take the Noble Eightfold Path is, you know, it kind of has three components. It's wisdom, concentration, and ethics. Whether it's the concentration branch is right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So it's just been focus on meditation, but not really on ethics and wisdom so much. And when you just pull the mindfulness out of its context, it becomes something else, and it's not right mindfulness anymore. Just a few paragraphs I wanted to share from their article, where they're saying, the rush to secularize and commodify mindfulness into a marketable technique may be leading to an unfortunate denaturing of this ancient practice, which was intended for far more than relieving a headache, reducing blood pressure, or helping executives become better focused and more productive. But mindfulness, as understood and practiced within the Buddhist tradition, is not merely an ethically neutral technique for reducing stress and improving concentration. Rather, mindfulness is a distinct quality of attention that is dependent upon and influenced by many other factors. The nature of our thoughts, speech and actions, our way of making a living, and our efforts to avoid unwholesome and unskillful behaviors while developing those that are conducive to wise action, social harmony, and compassion. This is why Buddhists differentiate between right mindfulness and wrong mindfulness. The distinction is not moralistic. The issue is whether the quality of awareness is characterized by wholesome intentions and positive mental qualities that lead to human flourishing and optimal well-being for others as well as oneself. So, and I think this is like, the critique isn't so much of practitioner per se, but those who are promoting the practice and pulling out this little piece. I think it should be a significant part of our forms and rituals is adding these components that's anchoring this practice in other aspects and reminding us that we're not, even though we may be coming here primarily for the ease of our own suffering and primarily drawn to meditation, perhaps, is like there is. At the end of this talk, we'll chant the four Bodhisattva vows and dedicate the merit to, you know, all directions, to every being in place, so forth. I brought this. This is a, maybe it's a further illustration, not that you maybe need to see more, but as I work as a chaplain at two hospitals and I lead a meditation group in each place, as posters were made in both places, I didn't really have a good image. It was like a woman sitting on a chair. I couldn't find ideally something, so I sent to the sort of promotions people, and what they came up with, you know, in each place, this were basically an image like this, where this, like, you've seen it, the versions of it, like both hospitals, and it's this is kind of the pop image of mindfulness and meditation. It's like, yeah, so it's sitting, you know, in a beautiful place, you know, nobody's bothering you here, right? And it's sort of separate from everyday life, you know. Yeah, and that sort of, it looks very blissful. So that, I think that is the, how mainstream society tends to, you know, mindfulness. And it's a little unfortunate, because then you come and you expect you're going to have this experience, and then you encounter your own body and feelings and mind and, you know, and perceptions and ideas and all of this, and like, this isn't for me. Which is not actually how the Buddha teaches mindfulness. So, as I mentioned already, it's right mindfulness is one of eight aspects of the Noble Eightfold Path, and it's particularly important, and this is one way to understand the pronunciation of the Satipatthana as the direct path, that right mindfulness is the aspect of these eight that is most directly responsible for uncovering things as they are, and it's a mental quality that enables wisdom to arise. And in this branch of concentration, it's placed between effort or energy and concentration, so we need a certain effort and energy to counter distraction. You know, especially as we sit down, each period of zazen or you know, the beginning of a half-day sitting or something like that, we need a little more effort to just, you know, bring ourselves here to, you know, to remember, to recall, to come back to the present moment. In order to establish mindfulness. And the establishment of mindfulness in turn leads to the development of concentration and a calm mind. And I might say more later about the relationship between mindfulness and concentration and the differentiation of them. I'm not going into that too much today, but the quality of mindfulness is to, in contrast to effort to some extent, but it's to never actually interfere with what happens in the mind. It doesn't try to, you know, get in the way and alter our experience. We're asked to bring forth a kind of non-attached observation of what's happening. I mentioned Reb Anderson at Gringolz used to talk about our practice of zazen and stay close and do nothing, to just be right there with what's happening without trying to change it. be impartially aware of what's arising and falling away in our lives without reacting and getting caught in like and dislikes. One example is as the sutra gets to the section on the mind, it says that he or she knows just says, he or she knows a deluded mind is a deluded mind, and that there's not like a need to identify the mind with and positioning itself. It's just an sort of imposing permanence. It's like you're just aware that the delusion is present and in the mind that's observed, and there's like not a judgment about it. It's not like, darn, you know, I can't do this. It's like to even to be mindful of the fact that there's, you know, delusion is mindfulness, and that is the practice. It's not trying to change it. So rather, it's just to observe clearly and really honestly what is happening. And it takes a little courage to face ourselves in this way, to be present and not to desire to be otherwise. And to look straight at what is. And it sounds good, I think, and yet are we actually willing to see our own delusions, our own pettiness? And we can imagine as well what it might be like to, for some thought pattern that we're prone at getting caught in judging ourselves for, what it might be like to just observe it arise in the mind without a reaction and just sort of welcoming it, saying hello, there it is, delusion. Yeah. How this might be liberating, and if we have done some sitting with some mindfulness practice in some way, we might have had those experiences too of the sort of the liberating aspect when there's something that tends to hook us that we're not being hooked by right then. We can actually allow for that to be and to see it for what it is without reacting, without trying to getting caught in stories about it or suppressing it, or either way, just being with things as they are. And it takes a certain discipline to do this. And so the sutta uses this rather perplexing language where we're asked to contemplate each of the four satipatthanas through themselves. It's like it says to contemplate the body in the body, the feelings in the feelings, the mind in the mind, and the dharmas in the dharmas. It's, I think it's trying to communicate as this kind of cool and calm observation where we're the object of our mind, you know, attention, mindfulness is also sort of, is also the subject, if that makes sense. We're not asked to, you know, study the body with the mind, which is maybe what we think of as mindfulness of the body. It sounds like the mind is, but the mind is there too. But it's really to go. This repetition of studying the body in the body is to really be go into the experience fully. So we're try not to get attached to the experience. It's you're also not separating from it. Yeah. Becoming one with it, for lack of a better term. And Buddhist teachers with a Western audience have suggested that there's a particular tendency within among Western practitioners to confuse meditation with psychotherapy and to really get caught analyzing the mental content that arises in meditation rather than to simply observe it, which is what mindfulness asks us to do. To just focus our attention on the process of awareness itself, to abstain from getting absorbed in the content, to let the body speak for itself and the feelings speak for themselves and so forth. We quoted in the newsletter recently, as we related to painting these walls, the Suzuki Roshi's chapter from Not Always So, where it talks about the blank screen and how I think the chapter, I can't remember what we quoted, but I think the chapter is called Everyday Life is Like a Movie. And I was like, part of what's fun about seeing a movie is that we know that it's a movie and we can both sort of tend to the story, but we also have some awareness that it's just something that's playing out. And he's encouraging us to not just be aware of like the content, but the screen where this all this activity appears to be happening. I guess this kind of non-attached aspect of mindfulness, to just have be aware of the process of awareness itself, where things are taking place, instead of getting caught up in the stories, the events, to be able to sort of take the backward step. And it's a balancing act, because we want to, on the one hand, avoid getting caught in content, but also we don't want to shut anything out. We want to make whatever's going on conscious and be aware of it, and not to eliminate any thoughts or feelings. Again, not to change our experience, but to deepen it. So, I think the trick is this thing of like to get as close to what's really going on as possible. And analyze that the more subjective experience can be seen objectively. And quotes Bhikkhu Nanananda as saying that Satipatthana is an objective approach to understand the subjective in one's experience. So it's this I mean, it's perplexing, this thing that just by supposedly, and I think it requires an element of faith to undertake this practice, that just by observing things as they are, there is any kind of transformation actually that happens through that. It's counterintuitive to some extent. Just fully being with what is, that anything would change, right? Our impulse would be to interfere in some way, whatever we're experiencing, and try to control and wrestle. And so, really, what this text is asking us to do, it's appreciating that it's not just Zen that's teachings that are trying to prevent us from controlling our own minds and so forth, but it's just to observe and be with what is. It's the practice that is liberation in and of itself. And through that process of when we're neither sort of suppressing nor proliferating on whatever is going on, rising for us, we're also cultivate this, came up last week, this kind of high tolerance for cognitive dissonance. We can actually get to know ourselves in a deeper way and form a more nuanced view of the quote self, so-called self, where we begin to understand that what we call the self is actually not a singularity. It's not a one thing. It contains many different aspects and pieces, and under certain conditions, certain thoughts and behaviors arises under different ones, different thoughts and behaviors. And as we get to know that, we're, you know, that we're not trying to control what we're doing and alter our experiences, we may actually, you know, alter and direct ourselves to, you know, the conditions for in our lives, right? We come here to sit together because we think this is supportive conditions for our own well-being and capacity to live and treat others the way in our lives as we want to do. Right? This is come here, sort of make the effort to get here, and then, but then once we're here and sitting, we're not trying to control our minds and thoughts and feelings, and it's just like, all right, good enough, you got here, and now let the Buddha within just come forth. So those are my thoughts for tonight. Thank you very much.